Hey, you've probably heard about SolarWinds and some of the issues they had a few years back. But if you'd like to hear from the person who is really there, I've got Tim Brown on this episode, the CISO. Stick around. You're going to want to hear this. Hello and welcome to another episode of the CISO Trade Draft, the podcast that provides you with the information, knowledge, and wisdom to be a more effective cybersecurity leader. My name is G. Mark Hardy. I'm your host for today. I have with me Tim Brown, and we are here at Black Hat and having a wonderful time here in Las Vegas, baby. Tim, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, for those who are not familiar with CISO Trade Draft, welcome to the show. Please follow us or go ahead and give us a plus up at the end. Make sure you like us, and then other people will be able to find us. We also have a Substack newsletter. Follow us on LinkedIn. We have a lot of great material there. But back here to Tim and SolarWinds. So there's been a lot of information, disinformation, stories, and things like in that. But to a large extent, you were really kind of at the nexus of all these things. And if you pardon the expression, the poster child for CISOs when life goes bad.
Yeah, I think so. So, as you said, December 2020, a long time ago. And that's when we got a call from Mandiant, got a call from Kevin Mandiant on a Saturday morning. And they always happen on Saturday mornings before.
See how they work.
Yeah. and essentially, a few things that were different about this. One was that SVR had broken into our back end and changed our code, which is really unheard of from an attack model. The other is what that does for your investigation, right? So we were shared decompiled code, clearly not ours. So stage one of Saturday is, well, was it real? Mm-hmm. Well, it was pretty quick to figure out it was real, right? Here it is. Oh, where else can we find it? What other versions were tainted? What else happened? So all of those things start going on. And now it's crazy right in the middle of COVID. So everybody's working remote. We stayed remote on Saturday. Essentially, then we came in on Sunday, had two war rooms, one upstairs, one downstairs, and, you know, worked through the issue, didn't leave until, well, I did take Christmas Day off. But
that was awfully nice of you. You gave yourself a day off.
But that was it. So we were working straight through for 3 weeks and just basically living at the office.
Wow.
And, yeah, we got a lot done, tried to, you know, keep the right themes in mind. Yeah, some of the important things to think about during those is, you know, your CEO should be prepared to take a leadership position, because they always do. So in your tabletops and other things that you do for testing, have them, right? That this, because I don't know if any room that I've ever been into that the CEO is not at the front of the table and giving direction. Mm-hmm. So why would you expect it to be different in other ways?
Well, that's a very good point. And you've got about half a dozen things in there just to
I know.
So let's dive into a couple. First of all, yeah. SVR. Who yeah. are they and for whom do they work?
The Russian SVR.
Yes.
So state agency. Theory goes, so we did not do attribution. So note that right. attribution was provided by U.S. government. Attribution was provided by researchers. So Russian SVR seems to be focused on four government agencies primarily, and being able to infiltrate their back ends to be able to, you know, essentially compromise and scale data and do harm in those back ends. We don't know what went on there, so we can't. But we know that four government agencies ended up being compromised in some way. So we were not the target.
Right. You're the conduit.
Through the conduit to the target.
Which brings up the whole question, which you'll get into a little bit later, on supply chain. Yeah. Supply chain security. Well, the next question then. Okay, so that SVR gets in there. For those, most people who are here are CISOs, they understand what SolarWinds is and does. But in case somebody is not familiar, why don't you explain a little bit about what the...
Been around for 25 years. Mm-hmm. Really focused on... Before observability, we're focused on observability now. Before that, really network management, number one in network management. So if you ever want to see, you know, at a retail business, every switch, every router, every system, whether it's operating properly or not, you go to your SolarWinds console. You've done that for 25 years.
So well, if you think about it, if you're an adversary and you want to get into a particular target, I could send a phishing email and maybe take over a box. Or I might be able to get a lateral movement, or if I get a God's eye view of the enterprise.
And the interesting part of this attack is they didn't go after us. Mm-hmm. They simply used us to move laterally. So we were simply, they didn't even crack into our products running in the environments. They simply used us as a foothold to be able to attempt to move laterally. We run on Windows boxes, right. So it's a Windows box within the network.
So it's interesting. So first of all, again, we're trying to overcome some misconceptions. So some misconceptions were, okay, they got into your dev pipeline. They went ahead and inserted code. That went out on the next update. And anybody who applied the update immediately applied the malware. Is that a-
so that's true. So 18,000 customers had downloaded an update. We don't know how many installed it.
Right.
But in order to go to that second stage to have impact happen, you had to connect to an unknown command and control server. And then you had to, they had to care, and then you had to accept commands from them. And so many customers had firewalls configured, other things configured, not having Orion on the direct internet. So when we look at the truly number of customers that went to that second stage is under 100.
And that actually sounds a little bit better because initially, when you have to provide that damage assessment, the clock's ticking.
It's at 18,000.
FCC said 18,000. You got to go worst case. Because if your numbers go up, you get in trouble. But if they go down, you've already taken the reputational hit. But in a way, people breathe a little bit of a sigh of relief.
The other thing that we have to remind people is, you know, the payload that was chosen by the SBR was this payload. Had limitations, right? Connect to a command and control server. Look for a response. Then take those responses and do things. Could have been controller code.
Could have been a lot of things.
Could have been a lot of things. So we have to take this as a kind of a not the end result, but hey, what else could we have, could someone have done, right? And how damning could it have been? So they could have just done random harm. They could have connected to the grid. They could have, you know, gone to manufacturing, put all sorts of code there. They chose this model.
Yeah, and Rob Lee was up on Capitol Hill in the last couple of weeks talking about some of the real issues that we have in America, specifically, but obviously around the world, in terms of the Internet of Things and all the operational technology and the real vulnerabilities that we have there, because OT today is pretty much where IT was in the 1990s.
Yeah, so and, absolutely, especially when we get to the OT environments. And, you know, just the kind of the complexity. Now, the... So just so you understand the attacker a little bit more, very thoughtful in their approach, didn't waste a lot of time, didn't compromise email to start with, figured out things and did a test run in October, came back in February with 3,000 lines of code with no errors.
And they weren't using ChatGPT back then.
And then left in June, shut down the command and control servers in October. We found out again in December. So the attacker spent good amount of time and effort to learn, to do reconnaissance, to implement a thoughtful attack. The attack waited 14 days before it started, things like that.
So it was a very patient adversary.
Patient, thoughtful, well-run mission. That's the way I like to think about it.
Now, typically, when we look at different threat actor groups, we tend to think of the Chinese as being patient and the Russians being smash and grab. Now, not always, but in general, that seemed to be the indicator. But here it was almost reversed to say this is a slow, deliberate mission. So let's speculate a little bit, if we may, understanding that it is speculation because I don't have any inside baseball on this. So if you look at the threat actor, they had a very specific intent in mind. As you had said, it wasn't the 18,000 customers. It was really, as you had said, probably four government agencies that were targeted. And if their payload were limited in a certain capacity, wasn't trying to overwrite switch code, things like that, they probably had to have advanced knowledge of what the vulnerabilities were in those target systems. It would make sense. Otherwise, why would you go through all this effort and introduce a payload that wouldn't work?
But the payload got them access to administrative access to the Windows box that was running Orion. Where Orion could sit, in this case, it had to be sitting, had to have an accessible route to the internet.
Right.
But since you're monitoring things, right, most likely sat in a relatively privileged area of a network. So it's easy to discover an Orion that is out on the internet, right? Showdown, right? You figure it out. Oh, well, so open internet, okay. So now I have a model that may work. And then when you get there, will it work? Can you move laterally from that, right? So I don't know if they knew enough about the environments they were going after to whether they could move laterally, but they knew they could attempt to move laterally. And then a lot of the follow-up information that came out from Microsoft, from Mandiant, from CrowdStrike, was about the secondary payloads that occurred and the models that they used to attempt to move laterally.
Interesting.
So
if we back up a little bit, then we say, okay, we've got SolarWinds. They have a product called Orion. It has a number of customers, been around for over 2 decades. It's well trusted. It does its thing. It's got excellent reputation. SBR actor group, identified by U.S. government agency, not USU, said, hey, we're going to find us ways to insert into your dev pipeline some modification that, because your code comes out and it's trusted, is then automatically trusted. So let's unpack that a little bit to say, any insight as to how they were able to get in there? Because you would think that a DevSecOps environment would...
So, any environment has gaps.
Yes.
There too. So email is one of the crucial ones. Is if you get into the lobby, you're stuck. Okay. Mm-hmm. Build system is in, floor 27 in the broom closet. So how do you figure out where it is? So one of the things that they did, so they didn't attack source code control, didn't touch it. What they attacked is what we termed our build supply chain, essentially to build the Orion platform big, millions of lines of code. So you start up virtual machines, and anywhere between 10 and 30 are running to do compiles. Mm-hmm. They put them all together at the end. What they did is they put a small service sitting in that build virtual machine that spins up and down. So it's not one that it's a transient virtual machine.
Not a Lambda, but it is a...
It's a transient virtual machine. It looked for this one file to be being built. When that one file was being compiled, it swapped its code in, compiled it, we shipped it, signed it.
And off it goes, because you had no insight of the fact that it had changed. So it's going to get a signature, and the signature is going to be based on the compiled code,
exactly,
not upon the source code, right? Because once you compile something, it's totally, totally completely different.
Absolutely. So, things that you could do to safeguard against some of those types of attacks, right? So we went brute force models. So today when you build Orion, now called HCO, when you build that, we do triple builds. Though no one person has access to all three builds. Couple of tenants we use to start. So one is everything's externalized. Mm-hmm. Second thing's everything's in code. Second thing's everything's ephemeral. We rebuild the build systems every time you hit the build button. And we do triple builds. So the developers have 400 or so have access to that build pipeline, then staging 36, and then production 2. And then we compare those at the end. Mm-hmm. And if they don't binarily compare, we don't ship.
That's very good precautions. And we say that's almost a belt and suspenders, but it makes sense. And it's not that expensive, you would think, once you figured it out.
Once you figure it out, well, it took 400 engineers 6 months to be able to do all of our systems out.
Right.
And add that resilience, add tamper resistance, so that in the environment, one person should not be able to affect the system. So one insider, we didn't find an insider in this case, but it probably would have been easier, right? So no insider in this case. But now you need collusion,
right?
Collusion is at least you need two people,
right?
Which is a bar that's a lot higher.
It really is. And that's why we put two-person control on a lot of things. We do that in the banking industry. We do that in the military. Okay, time to launch. You turn a key, I turn a key.
Exactly.
And actually, you have like 6 keys that all turn at the same time. So that we don't want to go
that's the way we took to harden it, right?
Yeah.
We used some other tooling after the fact. But again, so like reversing labs, you can compare results between one build to the next build.
Right.
You may have been able to spot that, hey, that's something that shouldn't be there. Because you're looking at the end executables, not the
right,
and does it match our source? So, all sorts of ways to do decompiles and look for source and match. So, a lot of hardening of that whole process.
So let's look at it a little bit from your perspective as a CISO.
Yeah.
So, and typically as a CISO, we're not in the build pipeline. We don't run the IT shop. The developers don't report to us. At best, we're trying to go ahead and get them to do secure things. So your first notification, you get a hold, Kevin calls you up on the phone firstly. I know Kevin. In fact, it was interesting. I was talking to Kevin when we ran into her speaking at the same event. And I said, I still have your old email address from Errols.com. So the 1990s, and we'd like, gone from that one. But anyway, you've got a couple of things. First of all, obviously you need to go ahead and mobilize your response team. Also, then there's a bring up the question of compliance, because yeah. that's becoming more and more of an issue for CISOs today. So what are the reporting requirements today, and how do they differ from 5 years ago?
Yeah, five years ago, so as a public company, we were a public company then, you had you didn't have a fixed period of time to be able to necessarily report.
Right.
So we reported on Monday morning before the market opened, which was beating today's requirements. Right. Today's requirements, 48 hours once it's determined material. In this type of an event, some things are granted, right? This is material, right? There's no question.
Oh, yeah. Right?
So you sometimes you in other ones you debate, right? But we report, we issued our 8K on Monday morning before the market opened. So we beat the requirements today. We tried to be as transparent as possible in that and tried to not downplay what went on. There were questions from the SEC on whether we did that or not, whether we were transparent enough. But that was the attempt, right? And we were one of the sort of early test cases for this reporting structure.
Now, you mentioned the word material, so it's important to define material. Who gets to define what is material in an organization?
Definitely not the CISO.
Definitely not the CISO, exactly. And if it has not been defined for you, you need to push that up the chain of command.
Yeah, so there's a number of things that are, that, you know, I tell CISOs to help them not get into trouble.
Right.
One is clear job description of what they do and what they don't do. Mm-hmm. So who discovers material, who determines materiality, right? You may provide input, but are you the one doing that? No, absolutely not. Are you writing a disclosure? Are you the one that is responsible for the disclosure? You may provide input, but there's, you know, 10 lawyers and a GC and a all sorts of people deciding what is in the disclosure. So you may help, right? But the interpretation can often be that the CISO has, you know, ultimate power and responsibility in these things. And very important to document what you do and what you don't do, right? If you're on the disclosure committee, say you're on the disclosure committee. If you're not on the disclosure committee, say that you're not on the disclosure committee. And make it very clear of, you know, how decisions are made.
And that's really important. I know one CISO who said that they worked with their management team and they determined $5 million for that organization is material. So if they say the impact is $1 million, well, to you and me, $1 million is a lot of money. But for their organization, that might be an hour's worth of run rate out of the whole year. They're like, yeah, we can suck that up. But if it goes above that threshold, and that is determined either by legal or CFO or usually possibly even the board, if somebody needs to go ahead and give you a line in the sand.
Right. And it's not necessarily just money. It can be impact.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Reputation. Inventory. Legal, all the other different kinds of risks that we can look at.
Yeah. So it's not a simple $5 billion, right? It's not a number all the time. So that's why you need the right people to do it, right? And those right people are usually your legal teams and your finance teams and others that can determine, all right, here's the scope of the problem. Here's how, here's where, how we made a decision for materiality or not materiality. Under the new rules of decisions around materiality or not materiality, we actually go through and document that process and then have our general counsel signs a letter saying that we've done these things and determined it not to be material. And so we have our...
You've got a paperwork record.
And you have a paperwork record that says, here's our...
Also, the lawyer signs it too.
Yeah, absolutely. Here was our response to this. We took it seriously. We did investigation. Here's the steps we took. And our determination was that it was not material.
So if you look at the chronology then, an event happens, you get notified. You go ahead, you go to general quarters, use the old Navy acronym or term, file your 8K.
Yep.
So you get the compliance up. You work with the whole team. You spend a few weeks figuring it out, sorting it out, coming up with a whole new way to do it stuff. And you think that once you've got it fixed, it's patched, you get notify your customers.
Yeah. So no, we notify the customers instantly.
Yeah, right.
Right. So Sunday, everybody.
Is that the end of your story?
This goes crazy. And we go through, you know, our support queues go up to 12,000. We update our websites. We communicate to everyone. We finally finish our internal investigation or external investigation with CrowdStrike at about 5 months in. So May, that was sort of the end of that model. Then we kind of push forward. We keep rebuilding trust with the community, rebuilding trust with the customer. Our last public quarter, since we went private in January, February, was 98-99% renewal rates. So
it's great stuff. No question.
We really did. We're able to regain trust with a lot of people by working hard.
And I think that's important because some organizations, I've talked to some people say, well, I don't want to work with that company because they've been compromised, or I only want to work with that company that's not been compromised. But we know there's only two types of companies, those that know they've been compromised and those that don't yet know they've been compromised. And usually those who've gone ahead and taken a hit have done a whole lot to fix things. And as a result, they're usually a safer bet. Because it has gone to management attention. They've gone ahead and written the big checks. Not there. So, but for you personally as a CISO, there was a follow-on of
Yeah,
this is where the story kind of gets.
Then another event. So December 2020, one event. Next event is we go through all of our investigation for the SEC and a few others. So you do depositions, you collect huge amounts of data. Mm-hmm. Every email that you're ever sent or read, they have access to. So mostly email communication. Mm-hmm. And you go through questions, you do all sorts of things. So in summer of 22, the SEC, what they do is determine a pre-Wells. So pre-Wells means that we're considering charging you.
All right.
Okay. So that's 22. And then at that point, it triggers you to have your own attorney.
Yes.
So that model says, okay, now you need your own attorney to represent you. Company is still representing itself. That's sort of the trigger point. Mm-hmm. So then with your own attorney, you're going back and forth. And there's probably 5 or 6 or 7 people on pre-well, something like that. So you're going back and forth with the SEC, answering questions, providing deposition, providing more data. And you do that for about a year.
Mm-hmm.
Now that year, from a legal cost mm-hmm. perspective, from my attorney only, that company is paying everything.
Okay.
Was over $1 million. So that's what has gotten a lot of CISO.
Yeah, the company started behind you. Now, are you in a D&O policy?
So D&O doesn't cover everything.
Doesn't cover everything.
So D&O is very specific to how it's written.
Mm-hmm.
And D&O did pick up some of the costs for this. But, you know, when you have multiple people under Wells, when you have multiple years of things going on, mm-hmm. This is all public. It's all, called out. The expenses that we incurred
right.
because of this were well over my million. We're closer to, I think, 30s, 40s, something.
Right.
So much higher. So your D&O and cyber, all of that stuff sort of runs out. So the company needs to keep funding.
And they did stand behind you. They completely reached you, like the scapegoat officer, and said, yeah, we're getting rid of you. And
completely stood behind and completely supported me for everything and very importantly maintained that separation. Of Tim's attorney and our attorney, right?
So you really couldn't do it on your expense report every week.
No, but that's...
Oh, that was a personal...
The company paid that.
Okay, they did.
Everything.
So it wasn't...
Absolutely. Your back pocket. Nothing out of my back pocket, right?
That was my first misunderstanding. It's like, man, I better set aside $1 million in a rainy day fund.
Company pays the whole thing.
And that's excellent.
And never saw a bill. It just went straight to the company. So then, personal attorney sometime, mm-hmm. probably like August, September of 22.
Right.
Then 23. So I'm sitting in Switzerland. I'm doing a conference in Switzerland. I'm in Zurich. And I got the notice that the SEC had charged myself and the company and that we were the only ones that were charged.
Lucky you.
The SEC. And then, we've gone through a path with them through our judges and other things and going back and forth, providing evidence. That point, new attorney, kept my attorney as a consultant. Latham and Watkins represented me and the company. Incredible job. And in July, the judge dismissed about 90% of the case.
All right.
There's something, small things left. Interesting fact there just in the middle that the whole process is you learn a lot. So you cannot present new evidence at this stage at all. So you have to make sure that you are representing either what's in the document, and it's a lot of it is unprecedented. That's why you need great lawyers during this.
And are you actually creating a precedent at that point? Because one of the thoughts was that, hey, maybe this is going to be the litmus case that, hey, if we can shoot this guy out of the saddle, we can then go after bigger targets because we created a precedent, which means you're sort of the 300 standing in the gap defending.
So some of it could be in New York, right? Just, you know, accounting rules and other things like that.
Right.
You know, that ruling. So you have to read the ruling.
But the same idea. Yes, this is SEC.
Yeah, this is the SEC. So, but you know, that we're very happy with that. That
mm-hmm.
So then we essentially had to keep going to be able to see, you know, how we can move forward.
Mm-hmm.
So that was from July of last year.
Right.
So now we're in August, and we've reached a tentative settlement.
Mm-hmm.
So details will get announced when the commission votes. Sometime in the next, you know, hopefully in the next, you know, in the middle of September is what the judge said to either come back to us.
Now, we don't get into politics on the show, but there has been a change of administration over this elapsed time. Do you think that that change might have any influence on it, or we just don't know? We're just going to sit back and watch it.
You know, new commissioner.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And they
seize on things.
And they decide and have a different view and different perspective. So,
because I'm thinking, gee whiz, that you as a CISO are supposed to single-handedly hold off the entire Russian SDR, which you're thinking, like, isn't that kind of a national government function at that point?
So it gets very specific in the charges, right? So it's very specific to, you know, essentially accused of misrepresenting security within the company or misrepresenting it through a public document.
So that gets into the subject then of what becomes public and then what do we have to be careful about saying? Do you always equivocate? Do you go ahead and hedge your comments in the future to say instead of we are secure, is that there's a high probability that we're secure?
Right. You have to be a little bit more careful,
yeah.
Right? And a little careful on different things,
mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah, that's just general lesson, right? Understand what you're saying, understand how you're saying it, understand the implications, understand responsibilities like what we talked about before, and make sure those are documented.
Mm-hmm.
So, the approval process for public documents, right? That,
yeah.
You know, we had legal reviews and, yeah, but did we document that somewhere that was discoverable in a process?
So you mentioned discovery, and one of the bits of advice that I've heard is that if you go ahead and you think you have an incident or do have an incident and you call in a company like Mandiant or whatever, then that all becomes discoverable. But if your law firm calls them in, then there's an argument there that is not discoverable because it's client's attorney privilege. And so there have been cases in the past where they have successfully argued that, no, this was...
Correct.
So what's the proper way to do it? Obviously, you want to figure out the answer.
So it's good to have everything done. Yeah, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but it's good to have everything done on their paper.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's what we did with DLA Piper was our attorney.
Mm-hmm.
External counsel, their cyber team, wonderful. But having them bring in help gave some level of confidentiality.
Right.
Whether it can be broken or not.
But at least it's a step in the right direction where you're creating obstacles for the opposition.
It's also efficiency.
Okay.
So you have to remember how many parties you have in this room. Right. So you've got an external counsel, you have crisis comms, you have your threat hunt partner, you have the Microsofts and the Mandiants, the reporters of things. So you have lots of different parties in the room. And if you can have the legal team managing some of those parties better where you're managing other things,
mm-hmm.
just becomes much more efficient.
Interesting.
So efficiency matters. And at this point in time, you don't want to add more to the company employees' plates.
Well, yeah. We also said complexity is the enemy of security, but it's also an enemy here as well. So we've talked about the incident. We've talked about the response. We've talked about the SEC and the governance and things like that, and then the impact and the fallout. So let's go to the concept then of supply chain security. As we look at now as CISOs ourselves to say, well, we depend on a lot of other vendors to provide us with things. And A, what's appropriate for us in terms of asking, or can we do due diligence on our suppliers, or do we have to press the I believe button? Or is there something in between that offers a level of assurance, some sort of good housekeeping seal of approval?
Yeah, right now, no good housekeeping seal of approval. There's been talks of that. Mm-hmm. Some things like U.S. government was doing secure software development framework, the enduring security framework,
the S-bombs.
So we've pushed, one of the way that we push forward is say that we want to be exemplary. Mm-hmm. One of the places being exemplary is in supply chain. So we have S-bombs for our products. We provide them to customers when they want them. We have VEXs that go with them. That's the any vulnerability that's found there. There's an explanation about what mm-hmm. vulnerability is. So we've taken that step. We've taken steps towards, haven't produced it yet. Well, SSDF, we were the first company to have signed, showing commitment to that. And yeah, that we internally audited before our CEO signed. But then looking at how we can have programmatic proof of these things that are supposed to occur, mm-hmm. that's one of the next stages. There's some good products that are working towards the kind of programmatic proof of mm-hmm. these things. We're currently using Scribe as a product, but right. to be able to provide programmatic
proof. Might be able to find half of them here on the shop floor here in Black Hat as you go walking them.
The programmatic proof side says it's not, you know, Tim Brown saying this, it's, oh, I've got a product that's looking. Okay, right. How many of your check-ins had peer reviews? Mm-hmm. Everybody does. Okay, well, my product says you had 99.9%, right? Mm-hmm. So product-wise can help you a lot. So I think we start moving forward mm-hmm. on that, and then you'll see customers requesting that. And customers looking to say, how can I have assurance? The other part is in the supply chain, understanding what is critical isn't always how much you paid for it, mm-hmm. right? Where it sits in the network, where what it has access to should be absolutely taken into account when you think about criticality. Right. So that was one of the lessons of the big supply chain, not the vendors, but on the other side, mm-hmm. you know, where do you sit in my supply chain?
Right. So what we have then is that if we're as a CISO and we want to ask, what should we be asking for yeah. from our suppliers? Is there a standard form? Please fill this out. Or, you know, if you send me a copy of an S-bomb, it's kind of nice, but it doesn't right. tell me about the code that Bobby the intern wrote over the summer that could be horrible,
yeah.
but, you know, it's not a third party involved.
So the there's a SIG that's a standard information gathering document. That one's been around forever and years. Mm-hmm. There's attestation. So SBOM's one thing.
Right.
VEX is good, but you need to have people that are going to look at it. But now you have a catalog of what you have from third parties. Then you want to have some assurance around how you do development processes, right? What do you have for procedures? What are you doing? So SSDF, ESF attestations are a good way to start with that mm-hmm. and have descriptions of that. So you can, with those, you kind of start building up a good set of, all right, this company is reaching these the goals that I have from a partner. And what we're hoping is over time, more will ask.
And the thing is, if you're an SMB, you can ask, but they're like, yeah, go away, kid, you bother me. But if you're an enterprise customer that said, you know, we're 8% of your annual revenue there, Mr. Supplier, you better respond to us.
And it depends. Okay. So if you make it easy enough, mm-hmm. so I'll provide anybody my standard documentation.
Okay, fair enough.
You want a SIG for any one of my products? You spend $200 with Pingdom, you can have a SIG.
Yeah, I guess it's a little bit like you've already had your audit or whatever like that. Can I see
it out
our SOC 2? Oh, yeah, I've already got your SOC.
Right, it's ready to SOC 2. You can have my ISOs. You can have the standard documentation, no matter how much but if you spend $200 with me, I really can't talk to you, right?
Yeah.
I really can't answer your questionnaire. Because I'll spend more than that to do it.
Exactly. And that's, you know, we were talking about this, I think, in the ride over last night when is about getting these queries for you as a CISO to say, well, hey, this company wants to know if you're incurable. So we answer these 417 questions. Or another thing says, well, here's our risk questionnaire. I'm thinking, like, isn't there like a superset of these things where you just put them all into one accredited database?
And everybody's trying.
Right.
So yeah. Gartner now is in that business. A number of other companies that have been there. can't remember the names of them, but they've been in there for a long
time. Yeah, and I've seen a couple that are trying to do that. And I filled one of them all the way out, and yes, the next supplier comes, or next company, no, we don't use them. We don't subscribe to them. We got to start all over again. And it's almost at the point where you'd like to guess, ingest this all, feed it to an AI model, said, read this questionnaire.
Yep.
Go on this one, fill out what you can. Don't hallucinate. And then let me know what is not known so we can finish that
up. And we do some of that internally, but we fill out a lot of questionnaires. Exactly. A lot of, a couple thousand.
But there's still sort of a self-attestation. It's like a self-signed certificate in a way. It's like, well, of course I'm secure. I want your business.
I'm answering your questions.
Answering your questions the way you want to hear the answer done. Which then, of course, we were talking about issues and liability and things like that. I guess that's not really an SEC problem, per se. If somebody gives you a liability question, you fill it out, and then maybe there's an error or a misstatement or whatever, something just goes wrong. The worst they can do is come back and say, well, you're fired. We don't want to use your product anymore. But they're not going to necessarily accuse you of misrepresentation, or might they?
I had a good conversation with my CEO the other day. We talked about liability, right? And that... should CISOs assume liability? And he corrected me and used a different word, accountability.
Accountability.
Right. And that, I hold you accountable for what you do. And if you don't do what needs to get done, I'll fire you.
Yeah.
Right. But I don't think you should be liable from a legal entity. And that was a difference, right?
It is. And I had an episode. It was actually based on what I used to teach when I had the Center for Naval Leadership, responsibility, accountability, and authority. And I can delegate responsibility. I'm responsible for getting something done. I say, you better get it done. And I can give you the authority to say, under my order, you may go ahead and execute that. But essentially, my accountability does not go away. I can't go to the admiral and say, lieutenant is a lousy lieutenant, and that's why we didn't do this. Like, I'm sorry, Captain, your career is over. And so from that perspective, it really carries over into our world as well, understanding that what we can delegate and what we can't. And it also kind of goes with the thing, like, if good news comes in, then you share it with your people and you pump them up. And if bad news comes in, you absorb it.
Yep.
You say, hey, that's on me. I'm the leader. I'm responsible for stuff.
And then, I think we'll reach a time of maybe more rules and more standard rules and things that we can audit against. We're a young industry, right? We're 30 years old.
Point.
We're very young, right? We're little kids. So think about...
I guess I'm preemie because I've been doing this more than 30
years. All right. Finance, right? I mean, they've been around for hundreds, thousands, right? And so when we look at how, legal frameworks could work around that, there is possibility for good legislation and... then official audits going at it, just like you do for your finance department. So, we may get there at some point of a kind of a true set of rules that we're audited against. And I think that would be fine, right? I don't think I'm not against it.
No, if you know what the measuring stick is, then you know what to achieve.
Right.
And it's a little bit like if I give you a blank piece of paper and say, achieve this, you're like, how? But if I go ahead and give you something that at least you can be graded against it, you have an objective valuation.
And you can be tested.
And you can be tested on it too.
Right.
You can...
So just like Sarbanes-Oxley eliminated a lot of risk associated with the CFO.
Right.
Right. Could we have something similar? And I'd be a fan of that.
That sounds
good. I just don't know if it will happen, but
I'm trying to find some champion in Congress. Maybe need one of our cybersecurity experts who's a CISO to go ahead and become a congressman and then say, hey, let me go
champion that.
Go champion it. And if you understand how that all works, it's an interesting world. I've got friends who have done that. I was actually offered a congressional seat.
There we go.
A few years ago.
We found a phone.
But it's interesting. I learned an awful lot in that process where I chose, maybe you don't want to go there because, as I'd mentioned, when you go from leadership to political, those are orthogonal, and it's an entirely different world. And if you don't like living in that world of politics and power and coercion and
very different
everything world. Else, it's a very different world. And if you're not happy there, don't go there.
Right.
You're probably better off. And I see most of the people who write the legislation are not the people who are the congressmen and congresswomen, the senators. It's the staffers. And the staffers are hopelessly busy. And so what happens? You've got the lobbyists who come in there and said, hey, I know you got to do something like that. I've already prepared this document for you. Most of the work's done. So now I go home on a Friday night. And then it works its way up. And it's much like the way that a lot of times we'll see these government contracts that will come out of the RFPs. And you look at them and say, like, this thing is pre-wired for somebody because somebody wrote it because the poor GS-13 who was in charge of it didn't have the time or the bandwidth or the expertise to make it happen. So as we get toward the end of the program, let's go ahead and try to think going forward. If you were to provide some advice and counsel for CISOs today, based upon what you've been through, the experience, and where you think we should be going, what would be some of Tim's rules or observations for life?
Yeah. First off, don't give up on it.
Okay. Well,
it's still a extremely needed profession mm-hmm. and job. And, you know, we have most people that are in this field are in there for the calling of keeping things secure mm-hmm. and trying to help the company be the best it can or their entity. So don't give up.
Mm-hmm.
Have the conversation about liability just to get yourself comfortable. Use me as the example, because if you just say, I want D&O, right, that starts the wrong tone. Mm-hmm. Tone is, Tim went through this, he was charged, he had to get an attorney because of process. You know, his charges were over $1 million. How can we make sure that we have those things covered, mm-hmm. Just like Tim was covered through the process? So just have a human conversation. Okay, so that should help people realize that the company would be behind them in some way. And so that's number two. Mm-hmm. Kind of number three is, you know, make sure that you are educating people on language and words and how to describe things in the right way. Mm-hmm. And because everything is discoverable whenever you get to a course, right? The other thing is resilience, right? We're getting... We're continuing down a path of transparency for good. Mm-hmm. So lots more CVEs being issued all the time. But the time between CVE and exploit and with AI going to be hours.
Oh, yeah.
So
that dwell time.
That dwell time is shrinking way down. So how do we build in resilience, right? How do we build in resilience? How do we assume breach? How do we assume that something gets compromised and at least limit the damage?
Right.
So we have to think differently from a defense perspective and be able to accommodate for tomorrow. So, but keep going. The other thing to remember is that the CISO you need the day before an incident and the CISO you need the day after an incident are different.
Uh-huh.
And a different set of skills. So it's okay that you don't have those skills, but just sort of expect to be replaced.
It's like being a combat veteran in a way. I mean, everybody can have great grades on paper, but when the bullets start flying, sometimes it's the people that you didn't expect. You know, like John McCain, who was like in the bottom 5% of his class, ended up being one of the heroes.
So
because he had the resilience to just stick in there.
So you have to decide. So it's
right.
Not always personal. It's not always scapegoat. It's not always those types of things. It's simply that, you know, the skills that you needed
mm-hmm.
or the company needed the day after were different.
So it's an interesting observation. So can we prepare ourselves for that? Do we have to recognize that there may be a day of reckoning where they simply say, hey, Tim, yeah, I'm great in this role, but we need to get a relief pitcher in here because of where we are. We're in the ninth inning and we want to hold on to this.
No question, right? And you have to realize that right up front.
So it's not personal, it's business.
Not personal, business, and it's the survival of the company in other ways. Yeah. So, you know, I was prepared for that mm-hmm. right on, you know, day one. It was like, okay, if I'm not the right one, understand, but I'm too busy to think about that. So I have way too much.
Kudos to your leadership team and your organization for standing behind you, supporting you, keeping you in your role so you could go ahead and give them the continuity and then take those lessons learned and be able to share them with everybody else. So on behalf of everybody here at CISO Tradecraft who is listening and or watching, I'd like to say thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
So for those who have been on the call or the podcast, thanks for tuning in. This has been Tim Brown at SolarWinds. This is G. Mark Hardy, your host at CISO Tradecraft. We hopefully found this useful. And again, give the other CISOs or people who are on their career track a little bit of insight about where to find their knowledge and wisdom to help them in their career. We're here to help you out, and that's why we exist. So thank you very much for tuning in. And until next time, stay safe out there.